Major U.S. stock indexes have fallen after consumer inflation hit a 30-year high, mainly blamed on disrupted supply chains. The World Health Organization says Europe is the only region in the world which is witnessing a rise in coronavirus cases and deaths. And concerns are mounting over the lives of 600 striking Palestinian prisoners, as two of them are suffering from serious health issues. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Wall Street has closed sharply lower after official data showed inflation rate in the U.S. has hit a 30-year high. All three major U.S. stock indexes have suffered losses, with the tech-rich NASDAQ dropping by 1.7%. Slump comes as official data indicates an increase of over 6 percentage points in the consumer price index compared to last year. High demand from consumers with spare cash plus a shortage of workers and disrupted supply chains have pushed prices higher. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that inflation is hurting Americans and that controlling it is a top priority for his administration. Biden has argued that his $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill will help bring down the costs. Opponents, though, of the plan believe that such spending spree will only accelerate rising inflation rate. And joining us from Mexico City now is Professor David Barkin. He's Professor of Economics at Metropolitan Autonomous University. Hello, Professor. Always a pleasure to have you on, get your take on things. What can you tell us about your thoughts on the rising inflation in America?
I think that there are two elements here that you just talked about that are very, very important. On the one hand, there is clearly the increase in prices. But what's behind it? I think that we have to understand that what is behind it is not simply the physical shortage of goods, but the unwillingness in the United States and the struggles in other countries to come to grips with the underlying problem of reducing social inequalities in all of our societies. The extraordinary supply chain problems and the energy shortage problems are relatively short-term problems if it were not for the fact that they reflect underlying social conflicts. The energy problem is a result of a deliberate assault by the United States against the oil producing capacity in Europe of the Soviet Union. I'm sorry, not the oil, the gas producing capacity of the Soviet Union. In the United States, much of the supply problem is a result of the unwillingness to recognize that a living wage is an essential part of the political policy package that Biden promised but is not being able to deliver on. The political stalemate in the United States must be understood as part of the underlying structural problem that is provoking an intensification of this inflationary period.
Interesting stuff. And Professor, could one dimension of it be that spending habits have possibly changed, possibly forever? Because right now we may be in the peak season because of the holidays, where people are going to get out there and spend. But for the last couple of years, you very well know it, people have been homebound. They've been barely getting out. A lot of businesses have gone out of business. A lot of businesses have downsized because of demand, because of the fact they realize that people could work from their homes. And, for the most part, it seems like people may be spending now, but their spending habits in general may have changed possibly for the next forever, or at the very short, next 5 or 10 years.
Well, I think that that's clearly the case. And the question is, are they going to be able to spend on products that are going to improve the quality of their life or not?
Mm.
You, in your initial report, said that some of the political factions are worried that the infrastructure program would be inflationary. I would be more concerned with the fact that the political stalemate in the United States doesn't seem to be willing to improve the programs that have to do with the quality of life of people, providing the public services and the necessary institutional support for people that would allow them greater leisure, but would allow and encourage them to go back into some jobs if the wage package included basic educational health and insurance features that Biden was prepared to propose, and which is at a stalemate in the United States. So I would emphasize, yes, spending patterns have changed, probably will change dramatically. But if we combine that with the environmental crisis, if we combine that with the other elements that are affecting what's going on in the world today, I would argue that the way to reducing the inflationary processes in this moment would be to provide the public sector package that is similar to the kind of package that is available in many other advanced countries, but that the United States, the conservative groups in the United States, have been blocking and are now going on a rampage to put a full stop to. And so,
and that's empowering the working class, right? More.
Yes. And so that you're getting more strikes, and that you're that the strikes themselves are going to create these supply bottlenecks until there's a realization that the workers themselves can provide part of the answer to improving the whole production chain.
Interesting stuff, Professor. Always a pleasure to check in with you. Thank you, and do stay safe from Mexico City. David Barkin, professor that is of economics there, joining us. Now, Europe is battling spikes in coronavirus infections, with many countries on the continent reporting upticks in cases and fatalities. The World Health Organization says the coronavirus deaths have risen by 10% in Europe over the past week alone. WHO says Europe is the only region in the world where both cases and deaths are steadily increasing. In Germany, a top virologist has warned that a further 100,000 people may die from COVID if nothing is done to contain the virus. Germany registered its highest rate of infection on Wednesday since the beginning of the pandemic, with almost 40,000 cases in a single day. France says its surge in cases means the country is now at the beginning of a fifth wave of the coronavirus. The situation of thousands of asylum seekers remaining stranded at the border between Belarus and Poland has drawn concern from the UN Rights Chief. Michelle Bachelet has described their condition as intolerable. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue in length with our guests. Here it is. Welcome, everyone, to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. UN Rights Chief has voiced concern over the migrant crisis in Europe as thousands of asylum seekers remain stranded at the border between Belarus and Poland in desperate conditions. Michelle Bachelet described as intolerable the situation of asylum seekers, calling for a resolution to the crisis. She said the migrants should not be prevented from seeking asylum under international law. The European Union is criticized for triggering the crisis, as its member Poland has deployed guards and security forces to block people from entering the country. Russia has also blamed EU for the chaos, urging the bloc to act responsibly.
situation is indeed very tense, and there's a tendency to the escalation of the tensions that cause our concern. It is apparent that a humanitarian catastrophe is looming against the background of Europeans' reluctance to demonstrate commitment to their European values.
Russian foreign minister has also separately asked the EU not to use the migrant crisis as a pretext to impose fresh sanctions on Minsk. Earlier, Belarus said the EU is causing the crisis itself and wants to shift the blame on the country to justify its new sanctions. And now joining us for the program is George Zamuli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute in Budapest, and Daniel Lazar, journalist and political analyst and author, joining us from New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with you in Budapest, Mr. Zamuli. Welcome to the program. Your thoughts, it's a very sticky issue. We understand that the economic strain of refugees for some countries, especially ones that are teetering along being third-rate economies, second or third or fourth-rate economies, it could really be a burden. That's understood, but we also have to take into consideration the plight of the refugees itself. Like I said, it's a really tough challenge to figure out what to do with these refugees. Your thoughts how Minsk is handling it at this current state in the game?
Well, I mean, Europeans have got themselves into a mess. A few weeks ago, we had 12 ministers of interior of EU member countries, including Poland, Lithuania, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia. They wrote to the EU Commission asking for funds to build a wall. They say, we need a wall because, you know, we have a major migrant surge that we cannot cope with. The EU told them, we're not going to give you a penny. They said the same to Greece, and Greece basically had to build a sort of a wall to prevent migrants coming in from Turkey. So the EU hasn't given any help to the Europeans who are in the front line of migrant surge. At the same time, the EU hasn't done anything with Belarus to try to resolve the problem. You know, after all, Erdogan did the same thing with his migrants. I mean, he's got about 3-4 million migrants that he could at any time unleash on Europe. And he said, I have a price. Pay me several billion dollars, and I'm not going to unleash them in Europe. Now, and the Germans paid off Erdogan. The same thing could be done to Belarus. I mean, all you have to do, pick up a phone, call Minsk, and ask what price Lukashenko will pay to stop this this migrant surge. The EU doesn't do that, and instead, it just imposes sanctions. Well, that isn't going to get anywhere. I mean, that's just simply going to escalate the crisis. So the EU really has very few options, and now they mumble about, well, maybe we'll get on to Putin and ask Putin to get involved. But the Russians have already said, this has nothing to do with us. This is between you and Belarus, and you're going to have to resolve it by talking to Belarus.
All right. Thank you, George. And Daniel Lazar, welcome to the program. Thanks for your patience. Daniel, your initial thoughts on the story.
The Poles and the Europeans in general are deeply hypocritical. First of all, these people are coming from Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere in the Middle East. And Poland supported and took part in, actually, the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, and also helped the CIA by allowing the CIA to set up a black site on Polish territory where they could be free to torture alleged al-Qaeda members without, you know, totally illegally. So Poland has helped to create this mess, this giant eruption of refugees, this growing crisis. Lukashenko in Belarus is taking advantage of it, but the EU and the Poles are completely hypocritical in painting themselves as innocent because they've done as much as anyone to create this problem in the first place.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Stay safe, both of you. George Zamuli joining us from Budapest, and Daniel Lazar there joining us out of New York. Thanks for tuning in to this segment of your News Review program, and goodbye for now. Now, there has been a mounting concern about the lives of six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails, as two of them are suffering from deteriorating health. According to relatives of Ala Araj, he is at high risk now of losing his eyesight due to weeks of starvation. Another prisoner, Mikdad al-Kawasmi, is also in a hospital after his health condition deteriorated. Both inmates have been on hunger strike for 95 and 112 days, respectively. Meanwhile, Al-Kawasmi's mother says that her son is protesting peacefully against his unlawful detention, but that the Israeli regime wants to kill him and other hunger-striking prisoners in any way. All the six prisoners are protesting against Israel's so-called administrative detention policy and want an end to their indefinite detention without charge or trial. Human rights and international organizations have warned that the health conditions of the six prisoners are deteriorating rapidly. The commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps has urged all Iraqi sides to respect the results of last month's parliamentary elections. According to the Iranian ambassador to Baghdad, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani issued the call in a meeting with top Iraqi officials. Ghani declared Iran's support for the final outcome of the vote, which is yet to be announced officially. He also called on the Iraqi authorities to address complaints about the election process within the frame of law. Iranian Ambassador Iraj Masjidi told Iranian media a top Iranian general also called for Iraq's unity and condemned a recent drone attack on the residence of the Iraqi premier. Iran says the return of all parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to their commitments is an important and leading principle in future talks. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says Tehran is ready to deliver a good agreement at the negotiating table in Vienna. That's where Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear accord have held several rounds of talks this year to revive the troubled deal. And they're set to resume negotiations aimed at removing U.S. sanctions on November 29th. Amir Abdollahian says Iran's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri Kani, is currently engaged in what he calls successful talks in Europe. Bagheri Kani is on tour to France, Germany, and Britain. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
Glaciers are like Mother Nature's bank account. If more water is deposited into them than withdrawn, then the glacier had a year of positive mass balance. A negative mass balance means that the glacier lost more water. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brian Manius Ryder. This article is published under the heading, 2021 was terrible for North American glaciers. Stay tuned for more. It started out okay. A weak La Nina arrived in the fall of 2020 and continued through the winter. La Ninas tend to favor cool conditions and ample snowfall. So the winter of 2020-21 wasn't bad for glaciers, but what followed was. In late June, the so-called heat dome settled over the west, creating exceptional warming that melted the snow cover on the glaciers and exposed ice in a matter of days. The timing was especially bad as it coincided with days when energy from sunlight is at its maximum. The hot weather also helped spark wildfires in British Columbia, Oregon, and California that spread through the mountains. When soot, dust, and debris from wildfires settle on snow and ice, it darkens the surface, causing them to absorb more solar energy and melt more. The warm conditions continued throughout the summer, and preliminary work suggests that these summer events led to exceptional rates of mass loss from glaciers. To avoid widespread loss of glaciers in the earth of the mountainous regions, policymakers need the courage to commit to meaningful reductions of greenhouse gas emissions. Mountain glaciers are vital reservoirs of frozen water. There are more than 15,000 individual ice masses in western North America, an area that lies outside of Alaska and the Alaska-British Columbia and the Alaska-Yukon borders. Glaciers are primarily nourished by snowfall during the winter and depleted by melting seasonal snow and ice during summer, releasing large volumes of cool water into headwater streams. Glacier runoff buffers aquatic ecosystems that can suffer from heat or water stress, especially during late summer or years of drought. To measure the year-to-year health of a glacier, scientists convert winter accumulation in the summer melt into a measurement called water equivalent depth, which can also be converted to mass. The sum of these two terms define the glacier's health over the year or its net mass balance. Glaciers are like Mother Nature's bank account. If more water is deposited into them than withdrawn, then the glacier had a year of positive mass balance. A negative mass balance means that the glacier lost more water. In 1965, two things happened that, at first glance, seem unrelated. The first was that Frank Sinatra recorded the song It Was a Very Good Year. The second was the start of International Hydrologic Decade, a period that aimed to recognize hydrology and standardize the ways in which scientists study water resources. One outcome of the hydrological decade was that Canada established a glacier monitoring program to assess and report how much water was gained and lost each year from its benchmark glaciers, including three in Western Canada, Peyto, Place, and Hem. Back then, Canada's glaciers were probably valued more as a water resource than as sensitive indicators of climate change. But make no mistake, even in 1965, scientists were sounding the alarm about the dangers of excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Since then, carbon dioxide levels have jumped 120%, and surface air temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere are now about 1 Celsius, above 1951 to 80 average. Warming of surface air temperatures since 1965 mostly explains the trend of mass loss from our monitored glaciers, looked at another way. Each year, the global temperature is about 1 Celsius above the 1951 to 80 average. Those monitored glaciers lose, on average, about 0.8 meters of water equivalent depth. In particular, glacier mass loss over the past two decades in western North America has accelerated, with losses in the past decade that were four times greater than the decade before. This acceleration coincides with warm, dry conditions over some of the region's largest ice fields, namely those in southern coast mountains of British Columbia. Although heightened glacier mass loss coincides with continued warming, accelerated mass loss may be driven by other factors such as changes to how reflective the ice and snow surfaces are to incoming solar energy. Debris, dust, and black carbon from wildfires or fossil fuel consumption can darken snow and ice surfaces, allowing them to absorb more solar energy, thereby enhancing melt. Warm, dry summers often favor wildlife activity and lead to pronounced darkening of snow and ice surfaces and more melt. Warm temperatures also allow snow grains to become less reflective, lowering the snow reflectivity and thereby enhancing melt. Glacier mass balance is the direct response of meteorological conditions during the year, but it takes time for glaciers to adjust their dimensions. Even if temperatures were to remain stable for the next several decades, glaciers would continue to lose and shrink simply because they have not had sufficient time to adjust to present-day climate. A modeling study in 2011, for example, showed that Alberta glaciers would lose 31-40% of their volume even if temperatures stopped increasing immediately. A more recent study reveals nearly complete deglaciation in mid to southern areas of British Columbia and Alberta, even under moderate future emission scenarios. Neither of these earlier projection studies take into account the most recent collection of global climate model experiments from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's sixth assessment report. The scientific community is currently using these scenarios to update projected glacier loss for many regions, including Western North America, which will help clarify the rates and pattern of glacier loss in the decades ahead. But we should anticipate continued glacier shrinkage since glaciers remain strongly out of balance with present-day climate. Sadly, losing these frozen reservoirs will impact us in ways we are only beginning to comprehend. A lack of real progress as COP26 will seal their future fate.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. We are here with an episode of A Muslim Lady, a program about our family life, especially a role of a Muslim lady in our society, in our home. So we are here to talk about different issues. And today we are talking about the tarbiyah, the upbringing rules regarding our daughters, because Islam has given such an importance to the tarbiyah of our daughters, and we have beautiful examples in our history. So with me is my wife,
Assalamu alaikum, rahmatullah, Razia Najafi is here, and I'm so glad about this program of Muslim Lady. So you said today we are going to talk about the rights and the way of bringing of our girls and daughters, yeah?
Definitely, yeah.
And really we need it, because usually we don't get in details the differences between upbringing the boys and girls.
And first of all, unfortunately, we do not pay enough attention to upbringing our children generally, you know. Nowadays, because of the hassles of life, because of our, you know, busy schedule, especially fathers, they don't have enough time to, you know, enough attention to their upbringing of their children.
Absolutely, and, you're right, yeah.
And secondly, and unfortunately, specifically about our daughters, you know how much important is their upbringing in our society? It is very obvious, you know, if we upbring our daughters according to the rules of Islam, according to the tarbiyah rules, then we can have a very good society, very good family in future.
So you can, according to Islamic teachings, the girls' upbringing, and their training, the way we have to treat them, is in so many areas of life, is more important than maybe boys.
And difficult also.
How?
Because, you know, physically, they have special, you know, sometimes needs. You know, we can't treat them as our boys, even in different ages. And mentally also, they are very, you know, sometimes sensitive, means emotional. They are full of love and emotions. While our sons, they are not that much maybe emotional. And
yeah, that's I agree. Totally
and physically
agree.
Also, they have different
aspects of their life. Dear listeners, let's have a short break and we will come back very soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to our beautiful show of Muslim Lady. And the way you are explaining about the differences between a training of girls and boys, I remember the beautiful saying of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, al-mar'atu rayhana laysat biqahramana. Like girls, ladies are like a flower, you know, the flower which is full of fragrance. So we have to treat them physically and emotionally, mentally, in a very gentle way. Yes?
And laysat biqahramana, they are not your maids, you know, you take work from them always.
I just believe that if we can propagate only this saying, everyone would get attracted by Amir al-Mu'mineen and Islam.
And there is another saying from the Prophet Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, khayru awladikum al-banat.
Beautiful.
You can imagine the era where Prophet and the Holy, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam, they were living. You know, the role of women in that society, how much they were ignoring females, women, daughters.
Yeah.
It is very obvious. They would bury their daughters.
Yeah, they would bury them alive. In
and
that society, if someone says, Ni'mal, I remember this hadith, Ni'mal waladi al-banad. Yeah, so the best among your children are your daughters.
Yeah.
And that is like a atom bomb in that time, because it's a big blast, because people were just against of people's mentality.
For example, the norm of society.
Yeah. For example, if something is really, really awful and disrespectful nowadays, and we say, no, that is like a diamond, you know, how can you are just ignoring that area of life? So it's really difficult for us to understand the situation of and the value of sayings of our Masumeen alayhi salam.
Definitely. And again, if we look at the reason why did the Holy Prophet say like this, or why did our Imams say like this, why did they give this much importance to daughters, we can understand that they are the center of our society, center of our family. You know, if they are full of energy, full of respect, they have, you know, got all their needs properly, then in future they can inject that peace and love into their family, into their, you know, children and husband. And in result, we can have a very good and role model family.
I agree with you 1,000%. Yeah, I love it the way you said they are center of the society, and we have to fulfill their needs. You know, like sometimes I feel like if you have a manager of your company, yeah, so because the seat is very important, so you provide everything to that manager. You say, you are running my company or my, you know, factory, so I have to fulfill all your desires.
All your desires, your security desires, your financial needs, your, you know, all the comforts which can divert your mind.
Now I can understand. Therefore, Islam has taken very easy, you know, about women. Yeah, like after, especially after marriage, she doesn't have that many, so many responsibilities. Like financially, she's free, you know, totally others are taking care of her. She doesn't have that much, you know, worries, and responsibilities. And also the house chore.
House chores, it's amazing. Regarding the managing the house also, you know, renting a house and buying the house appliances, and all these responsibilities lay on, you know, shoulders of husband and father.
Yeah,
that's why Islam says she has to have a complete peaceful mind. Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
Women in Imam Khomeini's idea.
God's mercy be upon these chaste bosoms that foster these lion-hearted youth. Imam Khomeini considers self-purification and knowledge as necessities by which women must adorn themselves with on account of their fostering role in the family. He believes that by bringing up spiritually refined children, both one's religion and worldly life will be safeguarded. And in addition, the prosperity of a nation is dependent upon the self-purification of its leaders. While giving a piece of advice to women, Imam Khomeini, he acknowledges that in raising children, they should not take their role lightly, because it is possible that the same single individual corrupts or reforms a society. He observes that a morally upright human being may educate an entire world, while a morally perverted or corrupt human being may pervert an entire world. Immorality and purity begin from your bosoms, from your training, and from the schools in which you are employed in.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will continue our conversation, inshallah, talking about the tarbiyah, the upbringing rules regarding our daughters.
Unfortunately, practically, we are far away from the teaching of our amazing Prophet of Islam. And kindness, a prophet is taking it very positively. And I feel this is the very, very deep connection between Multifat and the beautiful attribute of Allah, Ya Latif.
Latif,
you know? Yeah. So I feel this is the divine quality which wow. Allah has given and manifesting more in girls compared to boys.
Yeah. Totally agree with you. And again, it shows the beautiful qualities of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He has manifested us, especially women, with so many qualities, you know, inner qualities and outer qualities, appearances and mentally also. So if we walk on this beautiful path of Islam and path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then definitely we would not have all these problems which we are facing nowadays in our societies and in our family. So we are talking about the upbringing of our daughters.
Exactly. Yeah.
So during upbringing of our daughters, we have to be very careful, you know.
Okay.
If we upbring them physically, we give importance to only their looks and their beauty and their dresses and, you know, clothes. So we are upbringing a daughter which only will give importance to physical things, you know, in their society in future. So we have to balance between this physical and materialistic upbringing and spiritual upbringing.
The topic is so interesting, yeah. But time is over. So inshallah, we are going to continue this topic in our further episode. Thank you so much for being with us. And inshallah, we are going to uplift our soul and our spirit with the teaching of Islam regarding Muslim lady.
And especially regarding the upbringing of our daughters.
Exactly.
Inshallah, we will continue in our next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
U.S. President Joe Biden was once touted as the new Franklin D. Roosevelt. That ambition is fast dying, as are Democrats' hopes of remaining in power. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Samuel Moyne, a professor of law and history at Yale and the author of Not Enough, Human Rights in an Unequal World, titled, If U.S. Democrats Return to Centrism, They Are Doomed to Lose Against Trump. Please stay tuned. U.S. Congress passage on Friday, November 5th of Joe Biden's infrastructure bill would ordinarily have been a cause for celebration, but there is a good chance it was the beginning of the end of his presidency. After all, the bill's final days mark a new consensus around a century set of economic remedies chosen out of fears of what will supposedly happen when progressives with a transformative agenda exercise too much influence on the Democratic Party agenda. Only 10 months ago, Biden came into office with great expectations, but greater terrors. Even more apparent at the start than now, Biden's presidency has been defined by fear rather than hope. With the assault on the Capitol earlier in the month, the culmination of a four-year death watch for American democracy, the emergency could hardly evaporate overnight. With Donald Trump temporarily ousted, his replacement also drew 1930s comparisons. The question is, he or she isn't he? Had been asked of Biden's predecessor for 4 years. To redeem the country from the fascist, was Biden going to be Franklin Roosevelt? Like FDR, Biden led Democrats who have claimed economic transformation for the sake of the poor and vulnerable, but also for the angry and disaffected voters of the stagnating middle. But unlike Roosevelt, Biden's coalition is fragile, and fissures emerged to threaten his success almost from the start. Fissures that broke it apart definitively recently, even in the midst of Biden's infrastructure victory. Other causes were forced to the margins along the way. Biden subordinated even critical fixes to American democracy, like reforms of courts and elections, to the economic agenda. As for his immigration policies, which mostly resembled the disgusting ones of prior presidents, they were treated with a partisan silence, provoking rage among the principled enough to demand fewer cruelties and restrictions, no matter who is imposing them. But Biden got a pass because enough agreed with the priority to address the economic reasons. comparison to Roosevelt's first 100 days, which saw 15 major bills and gave the early phase of every presidency its name, Biden's first 100 days were bogged down. A COVID-19 relief and stimulus bill was passed, adding $1.9 trillion in emergency spending to the $2.2 trillion of the first such bill signed by Trump in March 2020. But the real hopes fell on the big-ticket measures for infrastructure and welfare that Biden resolved to purchase separately. After all, the American Rescue Plan was only meant to be a temporary stopgap for an American society beset with deeper ills even beyond those that the virus laid bare. The game was on. At first, the debate seemed to be about how costly to make the bills and how to fund them. This was especially true for the American Families Plan, which was supposed to take steps towards an American welfare state, including by making relief measures for children in earlier bills permanent. Progressives in Congress, understanding the risks, were lauded for an early victory in August, refusing to back the first narrower infrastructure bill if Democrats abandoned the second, more ambitious social spending bill. Centrists tried to tag progressives as the obstructionist, but the mainstream narrative remained that by holding infrastructure hostage, progressives were keeping centrists from returning to form. Even as it became clearer and clearer that the Democratic centrist senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona and like-minded Democratic colleagues in the House of Representatives were doing damage to the ambition of the bills, a breakthrough after generations of Democratic austerity and neoliberalism still seemed possible. Then came the critical events that allowed for the centrist breakthrough recently: the election for Virginia governor last Tuesday, November 2nd. In an electoral shock, Republican Glenn Youngkin won, and more important, Griswold and uncharismatic Democratic Party sage Terry McAuliffe, who had once held the governor's office, lost. Even though McAuliffe's reputation for decades has been one of the centrists on economics, he served as Bill Clinton's campaign chair in the 1990s. Centrists scored a narrative victory. Wasn't it because of progressive excess that voters were turning on the party? Wokeness derails the Democrats, one headline ran. Lawmakers in Washington scurried to marginalize progressives by passing the infrastructure bill, with some progressive voting no, and others citing promises that Democrats will still continue on to the welfare measures. The rush to adjustment was peculiar. It is not until 2022 that the Democrats will need to show something for themselves. And there was no reason to abandon the social spending plan. However, suddenly progressives holding tough, since some Republicans supported the infrastructure plan, were dispensable. The new narrative was that Youngkin won because of anti-racist rhetoric many Democrats have adopted, along with elites branded as out of touch by other elite commentators. Centrists saw a golden opportunity to call for a return of their moderation, including in containing spending. In an extraordinary op-ed, the New York Times called for an honest conversation about abandoning progressive goals across the board, including the economy, where Americans demand bipartisan solutions that respect inflationary risks and refuse to spend very much. The truth was that Americans had gotten bipartisan neoliberalism for decades, but no matter. One Twitter commentator noted that it was hardly surprising that the lessons from Tuesday, November 2nd election matched the ideological goals neoliberal elites had before the election and decades before that. What are the odds? Democrats blew by the possibility that McAuliffe's failures were mainly his fault, and due less to critical race theory that allegedly was already reshaping public education than to an abandonment of parents forced to endure school closures of years, itself an economic issue. Either way, the critical error is assuming that voters rejected progressive economic policies, which are popular across the board. Even before the events, the other day, Democrats defined what was in Build Back Better, their slogan and the name of the welfare bill downwards. Free college was stripped out early, family and medical leave, standard across industrialized democracies for decades were killed late, and Biden kowtowed to centrists who demanded a more marketized version, not just of environmental concern, but of funding government across the board. As taxes hikes were reversed. With his fate no longer hostage to infrastructure, in spite of written promises from some centuries that progressives reportedly exacted at last minute, there is no reason to be optimistic about the final bill's fate. An infrastructure bill for a country in decay and decline was much needed and has itself eluded Democrats for decades. Though cut in half to win acceptance, it's $1 trillion for a GARP bag of spending, much focused on transport, is nothing to trivialize. But rarely in history has a greater looming defeat been snatched from the jaws of a political victory as the other day. In the first year of Biden's presidency, Democrats agreed that the only alternative to barbarism is, if not socialism, some modicum of economic change. Many agreed that opening acts of Barack Obama's administration had been faithfully insufficient. Now, despite the lessons of the Obama presidency, Republicans are set to recapture one House of Congress after 2 years, or both. By contrast, FDR gained seats in both houses after delivering substantive change and won the presidency 3 more times. Of course, if progressives were to secure a welfare package and retain influence in their party, Trump, or an even more popular Republican could still win the presidency. But this outcome is a near certainty if the Democrats return to centrist form, as seems the likeliest outcome now.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.